What I propose to talk about in the next today and the next 2 days is the problem of Christian language, Christian witness in a secular culture. I'm basically a theoretician of Christianity, and the task of a theoretician is sometimes difficult. But I think probably the best way to explain what we can do is to talk about the relationship between theoretical reflection and the activity that is called Christianity. I don't pretend for one moment that theoretical reflection, however valid and however well put and however orthodox, that theoretical reflection can ever take the place of Christian faith. It doesn't do that at all. Faith, says Luther, is a busy, active thing. And so what we are as Christians is not determined by the correctness of our reflection. But I think action without reflection can really be blind, just as reflection without action is sterile. And so what we need to do, in one sense at least, is to have that kind of a theory, at least, of Christianity that enables us to be Christian people in the world. Now, that's the sense in what my vocation is. My vocation is to help in the task of reflection, the theoretical task. But the situation in which that theoretical task is done today is really a very difficult one for Christians to be in. Now, it doesn't seem difficult on the surface, and certainly not here at Holden does it seem difficult. We can announce a Bible study, and lots of people show up for it. We can have Vespers, and the whole village is there. And it doesn't seem at all as if the context in which Christian witness takes place is a difficult one today. Probably not even in our parish churches, where the life of the Christian community, at least in the United States, is a relatively vital kind of life. But I think the Europeans have long known the difficulties in which Christian witness takes place today. European churches, in large sections of Europe at least, are empty. They are really almost Nietzsche's monuments to a dead god. They are museum pieces. I remember being in the Cathedral of Amiens in France on a Sunday morning when they weren't even using the main church at all, when a small group of people were sort of huddled together in a side chapel for the Sunday morning mass, the main Sunday morning mass of the day, and swallows were flying around in the main cathedral, coming in through broken clerestory windows. Europe is dotted with these kinds of monuments to the death of God. In America here, the phenomenon of the death of God was very short-lived. It made Time magazine one Easter and disappeared by the next. So that in one sense at least it was as if somebody had staged a kind of commando raid on the fortress of Christianity and sort of slipped in and out. If you ask today where the theologians of the death of God are, I suppose most of us don't even know. Thomas Altizer is teaching English someplace now in New York, one of the New York universities. I don't know what happened to William Hamilton, and they were the two chief theologians of the death of God. Very easy for us to dismiss that phenomenon. People put on bumper stickers, "My God is alive, sorry about yours," as if that really dealt with the problem. Or Billy Graham's answer was, "Of course God is alive, I talked with him this morning." And this is all very reassuring, in one sense at least. Martin Marty wrote a book called The Infidel, in which he talked about the 19th century response to atheism, The debates were very carefully staged in the village hall, and you always made sure that the local minister had the last word and won the debate. That was the way the whole enterprise was staged. It was a rigged victory over the forces of irreligion. But we are fooling ourselves if these kinds of facile and easy responses, if these kinds of facile and easy victories lull us into thinking that we are not today really confronting a very difficult situation. What has happened is not only that the world out there somewhere, in Europe or in China or in Russia, or in the great university campuses of America, that the world out there has somehow gone secular, although there is mounting evidence for that also in American society. But the problem is that within the churches itself, the language that we use does not relate in any meaningful way to our own experience. That is, and now I'm talking about the central language of the church. If you really want to get a good crowd into the church, just announce that your topic is going to be sex or capital punishment or abortion, and people will crowd in. But if you're going to announce a series of topics on the Holy Trinity, there will be a handful of people there. It isn't all that meaningful. The great central affirmations of the Christian faith, God, the Spirit, Christ, the sacraments, these are the things that have begun to lose meaning for us, so that we don't really know what we are doing anymore. We baptize our babies to be on the safe side. Safe side of what? We're not quite sure. We go to communion because the minister schedules it once a month, whether we need it or not. And great numbers of people frequently flock out of the church when the Lord be with you. Is almost like a benediction as the communion liturgy begins. People take it as a sign of dismissal, especially if the minister uses the gestures. I was reminded last night of the experience of a little son of a friend of mine who was explaining to his younger brother all about the liturgy. And he says, you know, at the very end, the minister goes like this. And you know what that means, don't you? It means some of you go out that way and some that way, some that way. So what I'm trying to say is that we really don't know, in the churches themselves, we really don't know any longer what experiences, what concrete daily experiences of people are being expressed, being thematized by the central language of the church. That means then that in the churches, at least, we have three signs on the part of Christian people that this experiential relationship between language and what's going on in our lives is missing. One is that moralism becomes a very popular activity within the Christian community. People go out of church on Sunday morning and congratulate the minister if he has preached a moral kind of sermon. It isn't that they really are going to do it during the week, but they at least know what he's been talking about on that particular Sunday morning. If you're talking about some kind of behavior that people can carry out during the week, everybody says, gee, you know, I know what that is. I may not do it, but at least I know what it is. There was a cartoon in the New Yorker a few years ago of a bright-eyed woman coming out of church and shaking hands with the minister and saying, you make it all sound so real. Well, one of the easiest ways to make it sound real is to talk about your job. Norman Vincent Peale is very successful at doing this kind of thing. He doesn't really ask too much about the kinds of goals people have. He simply tries to give practical advice on how you can reach the goal that you have set, the psychological pep talk, sort of. The second thing that happens to religion is what I would call pietism. By pietism, I do not mean genuine forms of piety, I mean transforming religion into a private experience. What religion means to me. And it really doesn't matter what it is. I mean, Eisenhower was the theologian for this when he said, America is built on a firmly felt religious faith and I don't care what it is. some years ago, Edward R. Murrow did a series on what religion means to me. And everybody can talk on this subject. That's one of the nice things about it. It appeals to our egalitarian sense in America. What it means to you is what it means to you, and that is exactly what it means to you. Now, the beautiful thing about this is, of course, nobody can argue with what it means to you. It can mean absolutely anything. It can mean golden sunsets. It can mean swirling snowstorms. It can mean a still small voice. It can mean anything at all, and nobody can argue with it. The reverse side of that particular coin is it's very difficult to relate your meaning, that is, to relate it meaningfully to somebody else's meaning. The result is, of course, that while nobody can refute it, nobody can share it either. And I think it's no accident that that continuously in the Christian Herald surveys, the most popular hymn in American Protestantism is, "He walks with me and he talks with me and he tells me I am his own, and the joy we share as we tarry there, none other has ever known." Now, I mean, this is the ultimate in the privatization of religious experience. And it's beautiful, you know, it's irrefutable and it's also unshareable. If you take that song seriously, you don't even want to share it with anybody. You just—it's sort of religious show and tell time. This is what it means to me, and I don't care what it means to anybody else. Now, that the content of that private experience can somehow be very close to Orthodox Christianity, very close, but it can also be all the other things that I've talked about. The third kind of thing that happens, and this is, again, a symptom of the breakdown of the relationship between language and experience, is what I call the popularity of God demonstrations. We begin with the assumption that the kinds of things God does are going to be the very opposite of the kinds of things that man does. And then we look for those places where the human factor can be totally excluded. There we say we have a God demonstration. And that accounts, I think, as a symptom again, for the popularity of various kinds of religious piety today, especially healings, non-medically explainable healings. There we are said to have a kind of God demonstration. It happens in virtually all the forms of religion, Protestantism, Catholicism, and so on. I think that some aspects, at least, of the modern charismatic movement are a sign to the church that the relationship between religious language and experience has broken down. And I think we're going to miss the message of the charismatic movement if we do not understand that it is this deep symptom of the problem that we are dealing with. I don't know that it is a solution to the problem, but it has to be heard, it has to be listened to as a symptom. So in fact do all of the other things that I've talked about, the emphasis on morality or the privatization of religion. The point is, I think, that religious language is not regarded in our culture today as necessary, essential, either for the interpretation of our life or for action in our culture. It can be added if people want to. It's an optional part of life. For many people, of course, a highly important option, but nevertheless still an option. It really changes nothing at all to have this particular option. Now, what this means then is that even in our own culture, where perhaps 90% of the people believe in the existence of God, religion occupies that kind of place that is occupied, let's say, by athletics. Also an optional dimension in our lives, and a very important one in America. You know, millions of people watch football games on Sunday afternoons, but nevertheless it remains an option. We would no more think of having, let's say, a secretary of athletics in the cabinet than we would think of having a secretary of religion. Both of them belong, in a sense, on the fringes of our existence. They are the kinds of things that one drops when we're reduced to the essentials. All right, what this means then is that we are dealing with a mindset that can be called the secular self-understanding. And that mindset has probably been best described by Langdon Gilkey in a very difficult book called Naming the Whirlwind. I see Tim Weber sitting over here, and Tim was in a class where we went through this book back in 1972, I think. I devised study questions, reading guides, all kinds of other things to help students through it, but it still remains a very difficult book. What Gilkey has done in that book, first of all, is to analyze the deeper cultural grounds out of which the death of God theology emerged. It was kind of tip of the iceberg, and we very quickly hacked off the tip, but the vast body of the iceberg continues to float along, and it forms the self-understanding of the dominant cultures of the world today, Western and Eastern alike. This is one of the things I think that we share with the Soviet Union and the Communist China and vast other regions of the world. One of the notions is that religion is old-fashioned. It survives, but it's old-fashioned. Give me that old-time religion we like to sing when we're particularly nostalgic. But the modern world, the dominant consciousness of the modern world, has learned in the guts of its existence to do without what Pierre Laplace called the God hypothesis. That is to say, we do not need a God hypothesis in order to function economically, politically, industrially. In no way do we need a God hypothesis. When the Apollo 13 people got into trouble going around the moon, lots of people prayed, but we did not insert a God factor into the computers that was telling us, you see, what they had to do and how they had to conserve fuel in order to get the thing back. The praying was, again, a kind of option, which neither added to nor subtracted to what the computers we're feeding into the minds and machines out there in space to bring those people back. This secular self-understanding, which assumes that we can do without the God hypothesis, which makes religion a leisure time optional activity, has four major characteristics. And I've put the four on the board. Just dawned on me that I also put the three topics that I want to take up in the next 3 days. The meaning of religious language today and the experience of God. Secondly, the validity of Christian proclamation and the event of Jesus. And then on Thursday, the relevance of the Christian church and the activity of the Holy Spirit. But the four words on the, let's see, it's my left. Are the words that characterize the secular self-understanding. Contingency, temporality, relativity, and autonomy. Let me try to explain each one of them. The reason why this is significant is because this kind of cultural self-understanding embodies the axioms that we don't even bother to question. They're like the air we breathe. We take it so much for granted that we don't even know these notions are there, but they pervade the dominant culture, and they are in fact quite at variance with the kinds of things that we confess in church on Sunday morning. That's part of the reason why there is a breakdown between how we experience our world and what we are saying in church on Sunday. Contingency means that the world is the product of blind forces, blind chance. There is non-purposive activity. Rudy Edmond can give lectures on the formation of this valley, and he does so in terms of glacial forces. Nobody, least of all Rudy, imagines for one moment that the glacier has a mind, even though we sometimes talk that way. We say, Mother Nature does such and such, and there's even a butter commercial or a margarine commercial. What is it butter or margarine? I don't know. That in which Mother Nature gets very angry when somebody, I think it's a butter commercial. What is it? It's a margarine commercial, and Mother Nature is for butter. That's what it is. Well, so there are times when we describe nature in personal terms, but mostly we really operate as if the natural forces were without mind, without purpose. Now, we simply live in that kind of a world that is totally contingent, that is non-necessary and non-purposive. Everything that happens is accidental. Fortunate accidents in our case, here we are, you know, you lucky world, but nevertheless accidental. I listened to a lecture several years ago by George Wald, the Nobel Prize winning biologist at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in which his argument for the preserving of this world, his argument for ecological responsibility, was based on a totally contingent world. He said the chance forces that have produced this planet with its unique combination of distance from the sun and atmosphere and development, the chances of these forces combining to produce anything like the world anywhere else in the whole universe are virtually zero. And therefore, we've got to keep this world functioning as long as we can, because it's the only one like it. Now, his argument was an argument from contingency. This is not a necessary world, not the product of a purpose at all. It is non-necessary. Now, you can see how that notion conflicts every Sunday morning with the statement, I believe in God, the Almighty Father, Creator of heaven and earth. And we either then have to compartmentalize our thinking and out there, you see, operate as if there were no creator 6.5 days a week, and then on Sunday morning confess one, or perhaps even live in a kind of ghetto where we maintain our own religious confession. I think this is one of the really disastrous features of the conflict between religious language and the secular self-understanding, that it forces us either into ghetto or compartment. It forces us to choose between religious confession and the secular self-understanding. This means then that Christians can sort of shout their phrases, their creeds out into the world, but it's more like grit your teeth assertion rather than meaningful communication. I think this is one of the reasons, too, why it's much easier for us to find treasurers and financial secretaries in our parish looking for parish officers and trustees who maintain the property, because at least they know what they're dealing with. But try to find an evangelism chairman, you know, where you've got to talk the language out there in the world. We run from that, and not because we're impious or because we don't believe it, but because it does not communicate meaningfully to people outside of our own set group with its set of assumptions. All right, the second self-understanding in the secular world is what I would call temporality. That is, that this time is all we've got. There is no time beyond this world. So you've got to make the best use of the time you have. The Schlitz commercial, you only go around once in life, you've got to grab for all the gusto you can, is the perfect example of this understanding of temporality. The good life is here, and this is the only place it is. You want to live as long as possible, because that's the only way you can get all the living in. Death is the ultimate tragedy, so we banish it from our consciousness as much as possible. Last week we were on the subject of death, so I don't want to repeat a lot of the things that I talked about then. But the symptoms of death denial are all around us. Hard for us to talk about dying, to contemplate our own death. We have industries like the life insurance industry that really are about death insurance, but we have to cover it up with euphemisms like if something should happen to you. The funeral industry, if something should happen to you, you know? I can think of all kinds of things I'd like to have happen to me, but we all know the ominousness of this phrase, if something should happen. The funeral industry participates in this kind of death denial by making us think that people are really sleeping. And we use the language of sleep and slumber and fill our caskets with foam rubber pillows. And I don't know that there are any posturepedic mattresses in caskets, but I'm sure you could have one made if you wanted it. So temporality means this is all there is. We like to be frozen. We really like to be frozen at a particular age, the age when we're old enough to enjoy the world and not too old so that we can't enjoy it any longer. And hence we use Grecian formula 16 and the feel young laxative so that we can all stay in the Pepsi generation. Coupled with this is the sense of relativity. This is what really grows out of our sense of historical consciousness today. We don't really think in terms of absolutes. We think in terms largely of opinions, climates, atmospheres, notions which change. We don't really know who is right. I taught college religion for years, and probably the most pervasive creed that young people have is not the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed or the Augsburg Confession or the Small Catechism, but the unchallenged assumption that I happen to be a Lutheran because I was born one, but if I had been born in India, I would be a Hindu, and if I had been born in Burma, I would be a Buddhist, and all religions are true just so long as you practice them. I happen to be a Lutheran, but I'm surely not a Lutheran because it's true. I'm a Lutheran because that's the way I was born. Now, this is really the way most of us have, since the end of the religious wars, solved the problem of varying religions. We have stopped burning each other at the stake and instead substituted a kind of privatization again. I am what I am by accident, not by conviction, not by the notion that what I am is true. We shy, in fact, away from the fanatic because of the memories of the religious wars and the persecutions that went with it. So, historical conditioning means everything is really relative. Our moralities are relative, our truths are relative. We really are very unhappy with anything but pragmatic and relatively temporary solutions to the problems and difficulties that we have. We don't ask about principles. Finally, all of this then leads to the last of the characteristics of the secular self-understanding, namely that man is really on his own in the world. To make his own meaning, to make his own way. We'll do it on our own if we can, or in collectives if we must, but meaning is self-created. That is, I determine what is meaningful, and I'm on my own in that enterprise. Now, in this kind of a world, that is, with this kind of self-understanding, the language of God, of redemption, of purpose and providence, of creation and consummation, all of this language really has little experiential meaning. That means that we can talk it in specially constructed environments, we call them churches, where we have carefully controlled atmosphere by means of religious lights. You buy them from Augsburg Publishing House. They're special kinds of light fixtures and stained glass windows, which we don't have in our houses, and organ music and special vestments. One of the interesting things is that all of these things that today spell church to us were once part of a universal culture. Gothic city halls look exactly like Gothic churches, except that they have a different function. Stained glass windows were in castles and the homes of prominent citizens and town halls and so on, as well as in churches. The vestments that clergymen wear today, which are sort of special vestments, were once ordinary dress. In fact, they weren't even peculiar to the clergy. If you've ever seen Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro, you notice that Dr. Bartolo, who is a music teacher, wears a cassock. The vestments that clergymen wear today, which are sort of special vestments, were once ordinary dress. In fact, they weren't even peculiar to the clergy. If you've ever seen Mozart's opera, The Marriage of Figaro, you notice that Dr. Bartolo, who is a music teacher, wears a cassock with the white bands, indicating that he is a clerk, that is, one of the educated people in the community. Teachers, lawyers, as well as clergymen, wore cassocks. Even academic gowns in Protestant churches were once the normal dress of the faculty and students in European universities. So these things were once all part of the common life. Now they are only religious. And that creates the kind of environment in which it doesn't bother us to sing hymns which we really wouldn't sing in public on the street somewhere because people would think we had a screw loose. Our language, religious language, simply does not have universal capacity to communicate. We have to get people onto our turf in order to use religious language. I think now this is part of the problem that we face. Clergymen are almost always carrying their turf around with them wherever they go. So people expect ministers to talk religious language and they don't immediately call for the straitjacket. The laity substitute invitations to come onto the turf for Christian witness. The most popular form of witness is, come on to our church. We have nice music on Sunday morning, a lovely bunch of people. I mean, it's really friendly there. The nicest minister you can imagine, come to our church. That's what we call Christian witness. And the reason for it, of course, is that to say God is active and working in our church really doesn't communicate to people in the larger culture. What is needed then is, I think, two tasks that we need to engage in. One is the recovery of universal meaning for religious language, universal experiential meaning. Anything less than that is really blasphemous, because it means that we have settled for a God who has really been cut down to something less than God. Either God means something universal, something that is, that relates experientially to every human being, or we have an idol. You see, if we've only got the cult deity of a small group of people called Christians, or a little bit larger group of people called religious people, if that's all we have, then we really have an idol. We do not have the God who is, in fact, the Lord of heaven and earth. And if Jesus is simply the peculiar possession of a few people who want to be named by his name, then again we have missed the point. In the New Testament, at least, when they said Jesus is Lord, they were entering him into competition with the other lords of their culture. And they were immediately understood. They were not liked, they were not accepted, but they were understood. To confess Jesus as Lord was a meaningful statement in the first century. It meant Jesus was in competition with the emperor, or the pantheon of gods headed by the Lord Zeus, or the sun who was Lord. People knew what the phrase Jesus is Lord meant. They rejected it, but they knew what it meant. So what we need to do, first of all, is to discover those universal experiences which are characteristic of every person, and which give rise necessarily, not optionally, but necessarily, to religious language. And the second thing I think that we need to do in this process is to be faithful to the Christian proclamation. Some of the attempts to universalize religious language after the collapse of the religious worldview, some of those attempts simply were unfaithful to the Christian proclamation. I think the best example of this would be Immanuel Kant in the 19th century, who felt that religion was necessary. It was necessary to keep people moral. And the content of his religion was the existence of God as a moral lawgiver and judge, and eternal existence of the human soul, so that all the imbalances in moral retribution in this life, reward and punishment, could be carried out justly in the world to come. Now, that's not Christian proclamation, but it's what Kant thought could be salvaged and needed to be salvaged in the collapse of the religious worldview. So I think the one thing we need to look for is religious meaning, universal meaning. And the second thing is faithfulness to the Christian tradition. The agenda of the great thinkers of the 19th century grows out of this question that we've been talking about. And I include here, besides Kant, people like Friedrich Schleiermacher and Friedrich Nietzsche, the God is dead philosopher, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud, the people who were trying to reestablish the religious enterprise and the people who didn't see any meaning in it, both were operating with the same agenda. I think that's still our agenda. And I'm grateful for the 19th century for giving us this agenda, even though I guess I reject or am critical of the solutions of the 19th century. What we need then is Christian proclamation as an understandable option in our world. That is, an option that is intelligible to everybody, this in the same way that it was in the first century or in the 15th. Now, how can we work at that? How can we, if that's the agenda that we have, how can we go about it? I think one of the things that we need to begin with is a redefinition of terms like religion and faith. Simply to talk about what we mean, the word religion really has to do with how we value, what kinds of values we have. The highest value that any person has is that value on the basis of which his own actions in life are controlled. We don't always discover people's values by listening to how they talk. Richard Nixon was absolutely right. He said, don't pay any attention to what we say. Watch what we do. That was a profoundly religious statement. I don't mean to kick a man when he's down by quoting that. I'm simply trying to say that Nixon really had his finger on where religion is located. Don't look at a man's creed on Sunday morning, that with the hymns he sings, the creeds he professes, the sermons he listens to. Look at how he functions in his own life. We are continually giving away our own values by the kinds of decisions that we make, especially in crunch situations. You know, what would you save if your house were burning down? That's a clue, you see, as to the hierarchy of values in your own existence. Or how do you spend your time when you have discretionary time? Or how do you make concrete decisions in your business or in your community? We've experienced some strange things in this regard. People have been confronted with the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution of the United States or the Bill of Rights and asked to sign in the supermarket, you see. Now, we profess these values, but in point of fact, we're quite suspicious of the realities that are embodied in these kinds of American creedal statements. It's astonishing how many people reject the details of the Bill of Rights, even though they subscribe to them in theory. Now, the same thing is true of Christian profession. We give away, we express the hierarchy of values in our own lives by the decisions we make, the actions that issue in our existence. That's religion. So a man really is always practicing his religion. There is sometimes a disunity between the religion that we profess and the religion that we practice, but we are always practicing our religion, every one of us, as we live out our values. Secondly, I think it's been a disaster that we have divided the world into believers and unbelievers. Everybody is a believer. We are not all believers in the same thing, but we are all believers. Trust is not something peculiar to Christians or even to religious people. I think this is part of the bad legacy that we have from Immanuel Kant, that he divided knowing and believing and made believing a kind of inferior way of knowing. You see, if I can measure the distance from that door to the back wall, then I know it. If I just have to take a guess, then I believe it. That's the way Kant divided the world into knowers and believers. It's a disaster. Believing is really what Luther called trusting. Every man, he says, has a God. A God is that to which we look for all good and to which we flee for refuge in time of need. We trust our highest value. Every one of us does. And we act on the basis of what we trust. Whatever we trust determines how we act. If I yell fire and you all trust me, you'll get out of here. If I yell fire and you think, is this an illustration in a lecture, you will do exactly as you're doing right now. You'll just sit here and stay. What you perceive and what you trust determines how you are going to act. Everybody trusts. The question is what? So I think at least those two words, religion and trust, can be universalized relatively easily. But does that mean, then, as the 19th century philosopher Feuerbach said, that religion simply is the projection of our own fears and feelings and aspirations, that God is only man cast onto a larger kind of cosmic screen. Feuerbach said, religion is really not about God at all, it's about man. That's, I think, the final question that we have to face in at least getting back to Christian witness. There are two ways, I want to point to two things yet this morning, that give rise to God language and that are not simply dependent upon our vision of ourselves. The first of these has to do with our experience of being fated, and the second has to do with our experience of being guilty. These two experiences, both of which are at least potentially present universally in human experience, grow out of objective realities that confront us. When we finish with those two experiences, we do not yet perhaps have the God, certainly not the God that Christian faith confesses, but we at least know what kinds of realities religious language thematizes, and necessarily so. Let me take up fate first of all. We experience the fatedness of our existence at those points where we confront powers over which we have no control and which yet control us. That is, those dimensions of our existence where we are controlled without being able to control in return. Whether the name for that is fate or God or providence or whatever, the experience is there. The places where it is most acutely felt by us are birth and death. And I think this may in fact be one of the reasons why birth and death have traditionally been surrounded in almost every culture with religious overtones. That is one of the places at least where we encounter the numinous, the transcendent, or whatever. For we do not choose. We have no control over our being here. We may be able to control somebody else's being here through planned or unplanned sexual activity, or if Alvin Toffler is right, even through all kinds of genetic control. We may be able to determine somebody else's existence, but we can never, even theoretically, determine our own. And the most sophisticated ways of genetic control that are capable of our devising do not give any existing creature control over his own existence, that is, control over his own existence or non-existence. Ernst Becker, in his brilliant book, The Denial of Death, which was the 1974 Pulitzer Prize winner in nonfiction, and I recommend it to anybody who wants to read more, but Becker, in his book, The Denial of Death, says that the child's question, where do I come from, is not really a question in which he is asking for biological information at all. It's a question that grows out of the terror of not necessarily being here, you see. The terror of knowing there was a time when I was not, and I didn't have any control whatsoever over being. Now, I'm sure, you know, that a five-year-old who says, Mommy, where do babies come from, doesn't have all that theoretical freight involved in the question. And so if you sit down and try to give them a philosophy of the universe at age five, you may be somewhat missing the capacity of the child. Nevertheless, all of us may have experienced, or many of us may have experienced, this kind of terror when we heard our parents talking about how they almost didn't get married or maybe almost didn't have any children or something like that. I mean, that's when we realize how really fragile our own being is, and how we are really, in a sense, the victims of powers over which we had no control. I do not therefore choose my time, my place. I'm male, I cannot be female, at least not simultaneously. I am white, I can't be black or yellow or red or brown. I'm 20th century, I can't be 21st or 17th. So birth is one of the places where we experience this power. And the second place that we experience it is in the fact of death. Not necessarily the manner. There is some personal choice there. I can end my life sooner or later if I choose to take the means for ending it into my own hands. But I do not have any choice over the fact of it. Tom Stoppard, in his play Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, really deals with this. You know, we're on a ship and everybody's got to walk the gangplank. Everybody. There's one death per person. And his whole play is about this. Now, this kind of understanding of the universe, confronting powers over which we have no control and which yet control and determine us, may make us feel like victims. And there are a lot of people who say, you know, that's all we are. In one sense, at least, behavioral modification theories, thoroughgoing behaviorists generally regard us simply as fated people, victims who are not really capable of anything like guilt or accountability. I think there's a kind of built-in refutation for behaviorists. If we really are the victims of forces over which we have no control, then there is no point in really arguing that we should change our way of dealing with each other. And I think Skinner's little final chapter in Walden 2, where you see a glimpse of the director's room, total chaos, is a kind of illustration that there's more than simply behavior modification to our situation. So the other half of our experience of God is the experience that gives rise to human guilt. This is the sense in which we know ourselves to be accountable. And again, it is the structures of existence themselves that confront us with this. We are, says Reinhold Niebuhr, quite aware of our own relative insignificance and powerlessness in this vast universe. You look at the stars at night, you look at the vast stretches of history, and you sense your own insignificance and your own powerlessness. I feel it every time I have to walk through O'Hare Airport. You know, when I get on a plane in Columbus, there's at least a 50-50 chance that I'm going to meet somebody that I know and somebody that knows me. But I walk those long corridors at O'Hare Airport and see thousands of people coming at you and going behind you, and, you know, you're a nothing. You are a nothing. I really feel insignificant in that moment. But what do we do about this feeling of insignificance? Niebuhr says we struggle for power and prestige, either individually again or collectively. And we use our power and our prestige to justify our existence. The very fact that we engage in justifications bears witness to our accountability. The powers that control us also create a world in which options are possible and in which we make choices. And the fact that we choose makes us vulnerable to being chosen about. The fact that we become critics makes us vulnerable to critique. And there's no way out of this. That's the fate part. We are thrust by fate into a situation in which we must be critics. Even if you say, I'm not going to be a critic, you are critical of criticism. so that there is no way in which you cannot be a critic. You choose to be here, not somewhere else. But other people choose to be somewhere else and not here. We are thus vulnerable to critique. We are accountable for the kinds of choices and decisions that we make. We justify our decisions and thus bear witness willy-nilly to our accountability. No matter what form the justification takes, I couldn't help myself, or I have the right to do what I did, or I have the power to do what I do. Every one of us has his justification, his sort of apology for being around, for doing what we do. Now, what elicits these are not simply our feelings about things, but the very structure of the universe into which we have been cast. That structure consists of power and the critical trap, if you will. We have not, as I said, yet gotten to a point where we can talk about this in personal terms, but we have at least talked about what gives rise to language about God. I want to read, just as a kind of last word, a few things from C.S. Lewis, the fifth chapter in Mere Christianity. It's on sale in the bookstore, and I recommend its reading. He says, at the conclusion of talking about the grounding of the experience of God, that we have not gotten to the God of any actual religion, still less the God of Christianity. We have only got as far as a somebody or something behind what Lewis calls the moral law. What we can conclude about this somebody or something is that it is a great artist, for the universe is a very beautiful place, but also that it is quite merciless, for the universe is a very dangerous and terrifying place. The God that we have, or the God experience that we have, is not good in the sense of being indulgent or soft or sympathetic. There is nothing indulgent about the moral law or the critical trap. It is hard as nails. It tells you to do the straight thing and does not seem to care how painful or dangerous or difficult it is. If God is like that, then he is not soft. And it's no use saying that what you mean by a good God is a God who can forgive. You are moving too quickly. Only a person can forgive, and we have not yet gotten that far. If God is like anything at all, it is more like impersonal mind than anything else. And there is no sense asking it to make allowances for you or let you off, just as there is no sense asking the multiplication table to let you off when you do your answers wrong. You are bound to get the wrong answer, and it is no use either saying that if there is a God of that sort, then you do not like him and are not going to bother about him. For the trouble is that one part of you is already bothering about him. You may want him to make an exception in your case, to let you off, but you know at bottom that unless the power behind the world really and unalterably detests that sort of behavior, then he cannot be good. And if there does exist an absolute goodness, it must hate much of what we do. That is the terrible fix we are in. If the universe is not governed by absolute goodness, then all our efforts are in the long run hopeless. But if it is, we are making ourselves enemies to that goodness every day of our lives, and we are not in the least likely to do better tomorrow. There is no point, he says, in saying that when you started asking about religion, you really didn't want anything this terrifying. The fact is, this is the reality. Religion, says Lewis, does not begin in comfort. It begins in dismay and terror. And it is no use saying that you want something comforting. In religion, as in war and everything else, comfort is the one thing you cannot get by looking for it. If you look for the truth, you may find comfort in the end. But if you look for comfort, you will get neither comfort nor truth, but only soft soap and wishful thinking, and in the end, despair. Now, I think that's really a very good word of Lewis's. Part of what our age is running from, then, is the real experience of God that is there. And that experience of God, as I said, is not very pleasant. Well, I'd be prepared to talk with anybody around coffee about this. Tomorrow, I'd like to say something about the grounds of Christian proclamation, namely the event of Jesus, and on Thursday, something about the meaningfulness of the church.